How about we just kind of start the morning and let's just do the serenity prayer and just take a breath. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Last night I kind of alluded to how I did this. And I'd like to share it with you because I don't believe anything ever happens by mistake. And about 1988, I guess, I can't remember when I first did this workshop. I can't remember if there's a date on that, but it was probably, I think, around 1988. So it's been about 10 years ago. And I had heard many workshops. Excuse me. I'd heard Danny's workshops on prayers, what is it, prayers, principles, and promises. And that was when I found out that there was like all these thousands of promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I never even knew about. I was like, you know, it's have you ever thought you were a student of something and then somebody starts doing something and you think, God, I don't know nothing. And that's the way that I felt when I heard that. I was like, oh, my God, and the promise after this, and the promise after this. And I was just like, and she says, and now there's a prayer. I never had seen it that way. So I was able to do, which one of my most favorite all-time speakers ever and teachers was Chuck Chamberlain. And he used to talk about a new pair of glasses and how, you know, as we go along, we see things differently. Clancy talks about a disease of perception. And it's amazing because it just seems like as we go along life, more things, you just get it lifted up. And, you know, it's just like, it's just to me, like, I always think about just like curtains going up. And more things, you get to see things and you get to see them differently. And so I got this call and this lady says, well, we want you to come to a women's retreat. Well, I'd been to lots of women's retreats and of where I was a speaker. Okay. And she says, well, what's the weekend going to be on? Excuse me? And she says, well, you have to do the whole weekend. I said, well, I can't do that. I've never done that before. And she says, well, I said, on what? And she says, on whatever you want. And I don't know how you've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've been taught you say yes. That's what you're supposed to say is yes. And so I said yes and then instantly panicked. And she said, well, just do it on something that's really important to you. Well, just a few months prior, I had picked up Language of the Heart. And I had read it. And this the last letter that Bill wrote to the Grapevine, absolutely, you know, they're just things that may not do anything to you that it did to me. But it touched my heart, and it changed my life. And I said, oh, well, I'll do it on that letter of Bill's, Emotional Sobriety. And then I have this fabulous Al-Anon sponsor in Texas named Sally. And so I'm talking to Sally, and I'm telling her, she says, you know, I think a lady down in Brownwood did that a couple of years ago. I'll send you something similar to that. I'll send you her stuff. And what she did, I think I still have it. Now, I don't know. I am not a pack rat. There's not in a million years would I had something left like that. But Sally did. And so she sent it to me. And then her and I began to talk about it. And because a lot of when I think we're talking about this area of our sobriety has a lot of Al-Anon tones to it. Because it's about a real good look at self, and it's like, you know, there has to be somewhere, like I'm one of these people that preaches service, but then you can't do so much service that you don't look at yourself. Okay, but then you have the people who look at themselves, they don't do any service. They're too busy looking at themselves. They're so busy trying to get perfect, they haven't got time to do a goddamn thing, you know? So that's kind of that kind of thing. So, I shouldn't have said that. Sorry, I never cuss at the podium. And Almost never. Anyway, so, you know, there has to be the balance. You have to be able to be aware of what you're doing and be into service. So I always like to think this is kind of the Al-Anon side of recovery. And so I started working with Sally and evolved from that, the workshop that I did in Eugene, Oregon, and have been asked to do it many times since. And it's been very important to me. And it's like, I think this is what this really is and what we're going to deal with today is step 6 and 7. That's really what we're going to be looking at is character defects. And that's why I want to do some stuff with, and just generally with 4, 5, 6, and 7. And I love it because I think that I have the absolutely pro of step work, and that's Dainey's here, so that's like the pro of step work. I mean, I'm like quick. Here, we're going to do it. This is what you have to do. Poor Jill was last night. She was just swimming. I can't do that. Yes, you can. This so I'm quick. Shoot to the chase. So that's kind of what we're going to do today. So I'm going to just start off and lay the footwork. And you've got, did I have enough for everybody to get a copy of the stuff? My suitcase can be so, well, we'll have to just share. Here's one up here. I didn't know how many people, so I brought 40 copies and I needed one. I don't know how many I was going to need. Okay, great. Great. Okay, this is, this comes from the language of the heart. This is exactly as it is in the big book, in the book, Language of the Heart. If you're not aware, that is conference-approved literature. So, and you may find that this was a very strange thing for Bill to write, but it puts everything back. I know that one of the things that it's been real important to me to learn and that has been what I've strived for in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is to have every day to be of maximum service to others and to God. That's to fit myself, to be of maximum service to God and others. And that tells me that I have to fit myself to have a relationship with God. And if I have a relationship with God, I automatically have relationships with others. And a lot of times, sometimes that gets convoluted. And Bill's really clear on where the source is. Very, very clear. And I think that's real important. I'll just read along and... is anybody a really great reader? Somebody a great reader? You can come up here and read this. I'm not all that great a reader. I think that many oldsters who have put our AA booze cure to severe but successful tests still find they often lack emotional sobriety. You ever seen somebody that was 20 or 30 years sober and you think, God, I don't want to be like that when I'm 20 or 30 years sober? You know, mercy, mercy. Perhaps that will be spearheaded for the next major development in AA. The development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say humility, in our relationships with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God. Those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, and perfect romance, urges quite appropriate to age 17, prove to be an impossible but way of life when we are 47 or 57. Now, I don't know if you'd... I just happen to sponsor somebody who's just always trying to make this guy right. And we keep talking about there is no perfect romance. So that's one of the things. And what at breakfast were we talking about? Compromise, compromise, compromise. That's what life's about. Life is just a series of compromises. And... self-centered, self-seeking, little alcoholics have a very difficult time with compromise. So it's just, it's very difficult. And, you know, if you wanted me to, I could make you a list of all the things that I'd love to change about Dave. In fact, Shonda and I drove up here and I, you know, here was all this stuff. I said, well, finally, I've just accepted him the way he is because he's not going to change. And it sounds like our husbands are very similar in that, you know, I want Dave to just be this shining social light and all this stuff. And Dave just isn't that way. Dave is just very quiet. People always come up, is Dave mad? I don't know. Go ask him. But I used to go up and I'd say, would you stop acting like that? Everybody thinks you're mad. Trying to make him different. Anybody ever done that? I'm going to fix him. And I'm going to make him like he ought to be. Instead of accepting him as the way he is. So, I mean, I've been sick a long time. I mean, most of the people I work with have gotten a lot better a lot faster than me. I just seem to be one of these people that just trudge very slow. And I know the first time I heard that stuff by Dani, I thought, my gosh, how did she learn all that stuff so quick? I don't think you were more than 3 or 4 years sober or five years sober when she did this. And I'm like, oh my God. She has half the sobriety as me and knows twice as much. And that's been my experience through my whole sobriety, is that people with half the sobriety I have know twice as much. So it's kept me really humble. I mean, it's like, I want to know. I want to tell them. And that's not been my experience. Since AA began, I've taken immense wallops in all these areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and how very painful to discover finally that all along we have had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. How many times have you known what's wrong but can't stop? And I think the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is very clear on that. Self-knowledge avails us nothing. Steps 4 and 5 are useless if not followed by action from 6, 7, 8, and 9. 4 and 5 are just information steps. That's all. Just information. You hear people do you all the time, well, I'm doing inventory, and you sit there and you scratch their head, why don't they get any better? Because they've not followed up the inventory with action. How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result, and so into easy, happy, and good living well. It is not only the neurotic's problem, it's the problem of life itself, for all of us who have to go to the point of real willingness to hold to right principles in all our affairs. I don't think there is anybody in this room that hasn't been beaten right down to their knees in order to hold to right principles. And I don't know about you. I think there are people, but I can tell you about me. I know that there are people who come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and really have not, at some point in their life, been given spiritual values. I was not that person. I have always known what right and wrong is. I've just not done it. That's been the problem. I have taken a set of values, and I have absolutely violated that value system time after time after time. And I'm just like what it says in the big book, down and inside of every person, there's a concept of God. I believe that. And I definitely had that, whether it was this punishing God or whatever, which was the concept I had prior to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, the fact remains is I had it. And I knew what right and wrong was. I just didn't do it. I just kept violating my value system. Even then, as we hoe away, peace and joy will still elude us. That's the place so many of us AA Ulsters have come to. Now, I want you to remember that what he is talking about is the old-timers here. He is talking about the people who've been here, and this was his last letter, so what would he have been, 25, 24 years sober? Something in that area around there. And it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. Now, he's saying we've got to take a look at ourselves, because what happens is activity, as much as that's absolutely, totally necessary, and that's one side of our triangle, which is service, we need to look at the base of the triangle, which is the recovery. So we're going to have to take a look at recovery, and what happens is we're going to have, at some point, we're going to have to stop and do, as the book calls, self-appraisal at some point. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so because I begin to see many benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Last autumn's depression, having no real rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. That was the line that got my attention. Because I have been a person who's been plagued with depression all my life, in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it has caused me to do 3 suicide attempts, and it caused me to have, I always fought until I found this letter 10 years ago. For the first 11 years of my sobriety, I kept fighting that little voice in my head that said, if I can just get out, if it's just all over, I don't have to do this anymore. With a life that was fabulous, fabulous. And still had this little noise back here. Now, many years ago, I had been diagnosed everything, you know. The psychiatric effort takes a lot of serious look at people who are suicidal. Very serious look. And especially people who have attempted suicide. I began to get scared that I was in for another long chronic spell. And I knew that fear. I can still almost feel it. I knew what that fear was about because I knew where I was going if it caught me. And that was into this just mire of darkness. Considering the grief I've had with depressions, it wasn't a bright prospect. I keep asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people, on circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionistic dreams and specifications, I had fought for them, and when defeat came, so did my depression. And I began, you know, it's like I want the perfect sponsor, I want the perfect husband, I want the perfect job, and my God, I'm sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'm supposed to be rewarded for that. Now, this was, when I first got this was at 11 years of sobriety, and I didn't have the total surrender of feeling I needed to be rewarded for being sober until 16 years of sobriety. And that's when the total surrender came, when Dave lost his job. And the humiliation came with that. And most of the time, if surrender is most successful behind immense humiliation, I'm really sorry it has to be that way. Maybe you don't have to have it that way. But that seems to be what gets this alcoholic, is just to be humiliated to the soul. And then I can surrender. There wasn't a chance of making the outgoing love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute qualities of these frightful dependencies had never before been so strictly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut out these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, indeed, upon any sect of circumstances whatsoever. And I think that that's something that happens a lot of times. There are people who are dependent upon sponsors, are dependent upon the fellowship, are dependent upon their spouse, their mate, their parent, whatever. But unless I can find at some level deep within me to cut that dependency so that my dependency is upon God, I'm going to be in this state for as long as it takes to succeed in doing that. Then only could I be free to love as St. Francis had. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions I saw were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing love appropriate to each relationship of life. Plainly, I could not avail myself of God's love until I was able to offer it back to Him by loving others as He would have me, and I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. You know, we have a saying around here that says, to love for fun and for free. And I think sometimes that we say it and say it, it really doesn't have any meaning. But as long as, and I don't know if any of you have any of this problem, but when I started inventorying myself, you know, Miss Nicey Nice here, what I found out is I was nice, but my expectation was that you were supposed to love me, you were supposed to validate me, I was going to get all these things back from being nice to you. So I never did it for fun and for free. And what I've learned, if it's going to feel good, if it's going to give me all the things that I want in life, then whatever I do, I need to do it without having any kind of expectation in return. Now, I'll have people come to me and they'll say, well, so-and-so really needs some money, or so-and-so needs a place to live. And I'll say to them, and they really don't like to hear me say it, and I said, don't lend it unless you don't need it and don't expect it back. What do you mean? I said, alcoholics are not real good about payback. They're real good to take, but they forget to pay back. And I said, if you do it, don't do it with the expectation of you're going to get anything back. Because if you do, you're setting yourself up for a huge resentment that's going to eat your lunch. And I think that's, and I can tell you, I learned that from experience, because at a year of sobriety, I lent somebody some money. And I let that chew at me for a really long time. So now today, if I don't have it, I don't lend it. If I have it, they can have it. If they choose to pay me back, fine. If they don't, that's okay too. But I need it to be free. It has to be free. And if I haven't got a material item, I can give me free. And it's taken a long time in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to give me free, because I was always expecting something back. I needed some kind of validation because my self-worth is so low. I needed something back. And today I'm so grateful that most days, I'm not going to say all days, but most days I don't need it back. And if I need it back from anybody, it's always my poor precious Dave. He's always the one that gets it. He's always the one that just doesn't ever love me right. And he loves me most right of all. But he's the easiest to pick on. So I do that. I'll pick on him. For dependency meant demand, and demand for the possession and control of the people and the conditions surrounding me. Have you ever watched a dictator or, you know, a Castro or anybody like that? What do they need for you to do? They need for you to mind. They need for you to do it like they want, because it's the only thing that they can gather up and control. And if you're doing what they need for you to do, then they're safe. has nothing to do with you. It's a way to keep them safe inside and comfortable. Because without that, they, you know, they're lost. And they might have to depend on something else other than the gathering of people. And it's very frightening. And it always comes from a place of fear and low self-worth. Is that need to control. Well, I don't know if you have that. I certainly do. If I can, Dave has a saying with me, and he says, Polly's fine as long as all her ducks are in a row. But let a duck go out, or let something get out of whack, and I'm rushing, you know, I'm just like a mother hen, you know, just rush to get that chicken back in line. Why? Because that's what makes me safe. Has nothing to do. The chicken probably would have had a great time going off exploring, learning something, and coming back when it got ready. But see, it gets me all nervous. Got to get back in here so I feel safe and secure. So it's been a whole lesson of letting things go, experience whatever things have to go, experience, and being able to let go of that. And it's been especially difficult in the area of sponsorship. When I know without a shadow of a doubt you're about to go do something that's going to absolutely destroy you, and be willing to allow you to go do that and just, you know, say, well, in my opinion, I wouldn't do that. And let a person go experience that. And you know, I've done that quite a few times. And the results, a person comes back and, God, what they learned from that experience is absolutely amazing. And what if I had to put some kind of demand on that person and they didn't go experience that, they would have missed an opportunity to have a better relationship with their God because of what I thought was best. Very difficult lessons. Very difficult. Because I don't know what kind of alcoholic you are, but I am the kind of alcoholic that I am all-knowing, always right, and I know what's best for you. I haven't got a clue about me, but I know exactly what's best for you. Very difficult to be able to just take a breath and trust God that it's going to be okay. Trust God that that person has a higher power and it's not you, Polly. It's a very difficult lesson. While these words, absolute dependency, may look like a gimmick, they were the ones that helped to trigger my release into my present degree of stability and quietness of mind, qualities which I am now trying to consolidate by offering love to others regardless of the return to me. It seems to be the primary healing circuit, an outgoing love of God's creation and His people, by means of which we avail ourselves of His love for us. It is most clear that the real current can't flow until our paralyzing dependencies are broken and broken at depth. Only then can we possibly have a glimmer of what adult love really is. Spiritual calculus, you say? Not a bit of it. Watch any AA of 6 months working with a new 12-step case. If the case says to the devil with you, the 12-stepper only smiles and turns to another case. He doesn't feel frustrated or rejected. If his next case responds and in turn starts to give love and attention to other alcoholics, yet gives none back to him, the sponsor is happy about it anyway. He still doesn't feel rejected. Instead, he rejoices that his one-time prospect is sober and happy. And if his next case turns out in later time to be his best friend or romance. Now see, Bill, here we are. We had all these things about don't do all these things in the first years of sobriety. Or don't do this and don't do that. We were talking about that at the breakfast table. And I said, well, you know, when it comes to this areas of who you should date and what you should do, I don't get into that. I said, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is real clear on what it says. I am not the arbitrator of anybody's sexual conduct. That's between them and God. Now, I don't know if any, you know, if anybody needs any better instruction than that. It is there, very clear, that, you know, that is not my business. If you go out there and it doesn't work out, I just hope you have enough recovery to come back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and are not in so much pain you're going to have to get rid of the pain. It isn't about your sexual conduct or what you're going to do in early sobriety. It's what kind of sobriety do you have? What kind of steps have you done? What kind of service are you doing? Are you doing the deal? It doesn't have anything to do with anything else. I mean, if I look back and the first years of my sobriety are so shameful. And I will tell you right now, because of that behavior, I don't tell anybody to go do what I did. Because it was so shameful. It was a bottom, I feel today, that was worse than alcohol and drugs, was my bottom behind sex and relationships. And I can tell you today that, anytime I think a thought of that I'm going to do anything to violate my value system, I think about the shame connected to all that. And I don't want to go there. I don't ever want to go there again. So it worked out okay for me. It was a lesson I would rather have not learned, but I'm hard-headed. I don't think I would have done it any other way. Maybe I wouldn't have had it done to do it so early if somebody would have said something. But I mean, I was 20 minutes sober and I was like, this is the answer. Orgasm, yes. That's right. Oh. The real stabilizing thing for him was having offering love to the strange drunk on his doorstep. But he will know that his happiness is a byproduct, the extra dividend of giving without any demand for a return. The really stabilizing thing for him was having and offering love to that strange drunk on his doorstep. That was St. Francis at work, powerful and practical, minus dependency, minus demand. In the first 6 months of my sobriety, I worked hard with many alcoholics. Not a one responded. Yet this work kept me sober. It wasn't a question of those alcoholics giving me anything. My stability came out of trying to give, not out of demanding that I receive. Tough stuff. Tough stuff. It's really hard if you're a self-centered alcoholic like me to do anything without an expectation of something in return. Thus, I think it can work out with emotional sobriety. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love. We may then be able to 12-step ourselves and others into emotional sobriety. Of course, I haven't offered you anything really new. I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started to unhook several of my own hexes at depth. Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I have been given a quiet place in the bright sunshine. Did any of you know that Bill W. wrote that? Have most of you been aware of that? I was not aware of that until 11 years ago, that was even around. That letter was even around. Thank God for AA, approved literature, and thank God that I bought the book, because that's what began to set me free. And it's what I have learned today from a person who has suffered a lot of depression, is that depression is the disease at the very, it is the height of self-absorption, total and complete self-absorption. And I know today that when I start feeling that feeling, I better get busy right then and go find another alcoholic and quickly work with that alcoholic, or I'm going to be quick on my way to a depression. Because I am a person who cannot, I can't, you know, you may be somebody who can sit around and think about what's going on in your life and work that in your head, and it might be fine. It might not cause any, you know, harmful effects to you. But if I spend any time doing that with me, I'm going to be in such a state of depression I can't get out of bed. I know today it's like taking the actions. I have learned through doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous that I am a person who suffers depression because that is the byproduct of complete and total self-absorption. And the only way that I stay out of self is to take my eyes off me and look at you. But then again, we're talking again about that balance. I can't do that to the fact that I don't do any inventory on myself. So what I think Bill is trying to say here, which sometimes we don't always find in Alcoholics Anonymous because we're not people who know how to do a lot of balance. Has anybody ever done so much AA that they don't take care of their family? What does it say in the family afterwards? Anybody ever read that chapter? Huh? Anybody ever read that chapter? That it says it's we're no better if we're hanging out in AA meetings and we're depriving our families than we were when we were hanging out in bars. Anybody ever read that? We're no better. What difference does it make? We're still doing the same thing. Our family is still suffering the same consequences. There's something wrong with that. AA is supposed to make us better family members, not the same family member we were when we were drinking. My little Libra personality. Here I am a Libra and I want everything balanced and I have the worst time with it. It's like I'm just like over here doing, and this doesn't get done. Oh my God, now I got to go take care of this, forgot that. You know, it's just like this, you know, one of these people running in a cage or something trying to get it all done. It's like unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay, I'm going to go read on some of this other stuff, and then before we get into the character defects that we need to do for emotional sobriety, we'll take a break. So I know there's smokers in here, right? And we have smokers? We have smokers. We have smokers. See, now, if I had my druthers, I'd lock y'all all up in a room and wouldn't let you out till you were all done with that. As the big book so clearly states, if we want the AA Al-Anon way of life, we must become willing to go to any lengths to get it and be ready to take certain steps to stop ourselves from drinking and stinking thinking. Now, I'm going to throw something out at you that probably you don't have to believe. That's okay. It's my opinion, which unless I quote the big book, it's all my opinion. And that is, sober up an alcoholic and standing before you is a flaming Al-Anon. And then all of these, you know, alcoholics and, well, it's those people and it's them. Well, them have the answer and those people to emotional sobriety. That's why we're always pointing our fingers at them, because they have what we want. Which is, they can look at us and say, oh well, there she goes again, and walk off and stay perfectly happy. I didn't affect their life at all. Amazing. Amazing. We recognize these are symptoms. We must get to the underlying cause of our physical addiction and mental obsession. Most of us discover that a major cause of our living problems stem from emotional immaturity. There we are again. Now, I don't know about any of you, but I'm 57 right now. I say I'm 58, but I won't be 58 till September, so I don't need to be any older than I am 1 minute. But I'm 57 years old. I have got this attitude, mentality, whatever it is, of about 17. I think it's why we get along with young people so well. I mean, that's what it is. And then I have to get dressed in the morning and get, you know, I have to at some point look in the mirror. And it's frightening. Oh, my God, who is that old person in that mirror? Because it's this little kid who's running around all day, you know. And it's like, oh, my God, who's that? And it's because I just feel like a kid. I act like a kid. I do things like a kid. I think that's why I love women's conferences. We can just, you know, you can just be stupid. And it's so much fun. It's just so much fun. We have down in California, woman to woman, we all get water guns. And I mean, we are running around, squirting, and you know, you can see the old fuddy-duddies. Don't do that. I hate that. Oh, good. It's just, you know, it's just the devil made me do it. And it's just this kid that just doesn't grow up. But somehow or another, this mentality has to work, pay bills, have a relationship. So somewhere in there, you gotta get bigger. And sometimes I talk about this in my AA talk. When Dave and I were 9 and 10 years sober, we decided that we needed, I mean, I watch my babies go off on these tangents. And I just say, go, just make sure you don't stop going to meetings. So when you find out it doesn't work, you can come back. And the way you don't ever have to get back to basics is don't ever leave the basics. But I had to go find my inner child. So Dave and I decided we're off to find our inner child. Now, after we did all this, I want to report to you what we found out. I do not need to find an inner child. What I am desperately in search of is an adult. That is what I am desperately in search of. There already is this child. I think like a child. I act like a child. You know, I won't, I won't, I won't, I won't, I won't. And the thing that I have to learn is how to be a grown-up. And now here I am, 57 years old, 21 years sober, and I'm sure I've probably started to have the mentality of about an 18-year-old. I think that's why we don't have any problem with young people coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're just about the same age. You know, it's just amazing. We seem to be people who have no defense against the onsides of misguided feelings. I loved it when I heard, and I'm not sure where I heard it from. I can't give the quote now. A lot of times I like to give people the credit, but I don't remember when it says, I was a prisoner of my feelings. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous a prisoner of my feelings. If I felt like it, I did it. And Clancy's the one who says, take contrary actions to the way you feel. But the other thing I've heard is if you'll take this set of actions, the actions will change your thinking and the thinking will change your feelings. So it's all about taking this set of actions. But now I'm a person, if I were in the psychiatric effort, and you know how they have you do these Bataka things so that you can get to your feelings, I don't need to get to them. I'm one of these people, and I believe, again, we're on either end of the spectrum. You have people who can't find their feelings, who are just shut down to feelings, and then there are people like me who just feel, 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 feel. And, you know, what I need to do is take actions so that I can start to shut up all those feelings, because I'm about everything. I intensely feel, and it's usually I just feel and feel and feel until you've hurt my little old feeling so much I just can't hardly stand it. I feel so much. And so I've had to learn to do what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says, and I have learned to be where it talks about we are people who are just too sensitive, and I have had to learn to toughen up because I'm just like just feel, 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 and it's been hard. Because, you know, the least little thing, you say, My mother used to say to me, somebody says a crossword to you, Polly, and it hurts your feelings. So this was way before I took a drink of alcohol. Way before that. Or what? Who made you, who hurt your feelings? And most of the time, I didn't even know. I just had hurt feelings. So my self-centeredness was really getting honed to perfection by the time I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it had had a lot of work, that self-centeredness. We tend to go to extremes in coping with emotional pain and discomfort, usually through some kind of attempted escape. Well, I've tried alcohol and drugs and sex, and that was in early sobriety. Now I do shopping. I mean, I've got the mall crawl all the time. I one day at a time don't go to the mall. Just one day at a time, we don't do that. We become aware after coming to the program that the intoxicants we need to be aware of are not alcohol and drugs, but the emotional intoxicants. And this is what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the intoxicants that keep us emotionally drunk. Anger, self-pity, intolerance, resentment, jealousy, dishonesty, self-deception, criticism, fear, depression, and blame. And one of the things that I have added, and I can't remember if I put it in here or not, but also what we're going to talk about is gossip. I think gossip is such a destructive of human beings and human character. To achieve emotional sobriety, we need a couple of attributes. A willingness to change. And you know, sometimes it takes prayer. You know, we'll instantly think, well, I'm willing. And then maybe somebody will make a suggestion to you, and you find out you're not all that willing. Right, Jill? And that's not uncommon. That's honesty. And I think it takes that kind of honesty in order to become willing. If I placate myself, I'm not placating you, I'm placating myself. I need to be honest. I can't do that right now. Okay, then pray about it till you can. Pray for the willingness. Isn't that what the book says do? Isn't that what the book says? To pray for the willingness to change. Because I'm not always willing to change. Because I just think, I can't do that. Because my ego is so attached to it, and it's just like, I don't know, do you ever feel it? I got this feel spot right here. And boy, when this spot right here is on fire, something's wrong. Something's wrong when this is going. And when this starts to feel, then this starts. It's just like, this is like, turns the ignition for this. So, ta-da. Get to know yourself. Get to know what you're about, so that you know where you need to begin to work, so that you can pick up, what's that about? Better sit down and write about that. And then I'm trying to tell myself I don't know. I know. I always know. And a power greater than ourselves that will provide the strength that we need to change. Now again, that doesn't say sponsor, it doesn't say friend, it doesn't say husband. It says the power. And when I see the power capitalized, that doesn't mean that that's a human being to me. That means that God is the power. We must recognize that progress is an unending journey. And perfection is an unreachable goal. And while we have a long way to go, we must make the journey. To stand still is to stagnate. You ever talk to people who are saying they're staying home so they can find out what's wrong, or they can't go to a meeting because they're meditating or whatever they're doing? Okay, whatever turns your crank. Sounds to me like your water's just about to get real stinky. The following are some questions that set the moods as we begin our journey to emotional sobriety. I can be myself when I am in any situation I like. Can I be myself when I am in a situation I don't like? That's the key. And I think I've learned a lot about that. I can do great things when the wind is at my back. I can be and say, have all this profound statements and everything when the wind's at my back. But boy, let me be walking against the wind and the struggle is a little harder because I'm in a situation I don't like. I once heard a minister, and I'm not doing this because there'll be people who aren't Christian, and I don't mean to do a Christian thing, but I just want to give you this little tidbit, that what we're doing, sometimes we're waiting for a king, but God sends a Savior so we can live with whoever the king is. So it's being, and I say that a lot because I went through some really heavy job stuff with a woman that I just really, I mean, every time I went to work, I had a knot in my stomach. And somehow I had to learn to get peaceful within going to work with this woman. And it was a lot of work, and I just would always say that. I've got to be okay with whoever the king is. And I can tell you what worked for me. This is just a little sidetrack. One day as I was bemoaning this woman, all of a sudden, I had this revelation walking from the printer. My computer's here, and I have to walk a long way to get to the printer. And all of a sudden, I had this revelation. Oh, my God. I have this job with an 800 number, so it doesn't matter. If I work with people across the country, I am a free phone call. I have an 800 number, and I have a job that allows me to work with others on the phone at my job. Pretty damn good job. Not bad. And it took me that long to realize that how good I had it, and here I had spent all my attention on focusing on this woman. Program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You hear that in every meeting. Do you really listen to that? Why should we assume the fault of our friend, wife, husband, father, mother, or child because they sit around our hearth or are said to have the same blood? The power men possess to annoy me, I give them by a weak curiosity. Which means is that I can... If somebody has power over me, just like that boss, they didn't give themselves that power. I gave them that power. And a lot of times we believe just because we come of the same blood that people should be like us or we should be like them. Not so. Each and every one of us are God's special kid. We're each God's special kids. And it's been told to me that He knows us just like He knows every grain of sand on the beach. So all of us are God's special kids. And I can't remember where I heard this from, but I love it. That, you know, I heard a speaker one time say, I know God loves me as if I were His only child. And I think that's really true. The solutions rest with me. People can affect me only as I allow them to. I need not be influenced by others, for I am free to consult my own wishes and standards. With the help of my higher power, I can adorn my life with comfort, serenity, and enjoyment. It does not depend on any other person, and the sooner I accept this fact, the sooner I will be able to face myself realistically. Nobody's my problem. I'm my problem. Nobody is my problem. If we desire to stop or at least diminish emotional slips and binges brought to the surface and aggravated by the problems of alcoholism, then we are ready to say to ourselves, half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask His protection and care with complete abandon. When a drunk has a terrific hangover because he drank heavily yesterday, He cannot live well today. But there's another kind of hangover which we all experience, and whether we are drinking or not. That is the emotional hangover, the direct result of yesterday's and sometimes today's excesses of negative emotion, anger, fear, jealousy, and the like. It requires the admission and correction of errors now, found in the 12 and 12. How many of you have woke up after an emotional binge, as the book talks about, and feel just like you did when you were drinking? Emotional hangovers are real. And if you don't think your emotions play a part in your life, and that we have the tools in which to overcome this. The tools are given to us. It's just whether or not we're going to pick them up and use them. My favorite. It is a spiritual axiom that every time we are disturbed, no matter what the cause, there is something wrong. Wrong with me. That's a strong word. A very strong word. That means that I am broken and I better go find some tools to get fixed. There's something wrong. Finding ourselves locked into the intoxicating grip of certain emotions and suffering the pain of a mental hangover, from these we find it necessary to learn which ones are poisonous and threatening to our emotional sobriety and serenity. We learn that we can avoid these emotions and their crippling effects if we can act our way into right thinking. We do this by saying to ourselves, if it were not for da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, what would I be thinking, feeling, and doing? We step out on faith after asking God's guidance, and we try to remember, easy does it, but do it. And I do this a lot of times. What would I be doing if I weren't doing, you know, yada yada, this thing is bothering me, what would I be doing? And then I try to take the action to start to do that. We have the tools. We have the tools in which to have serenity and sanity. And to me, those words are real synonymous. You know, it's like, I need to work on my sanity because I don't like that churning feeling anymore. I used to just absolutely spin out on adrenaline. And I just can't deal with it anymore. I don't know, when I was younger, we have a lot of, you know, halts, like hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And I work with a lot of women who have problems with food. And most of the women I work with is that they're absolutely terrified they're going to gain a pound. Society says skinny's the answer. Monday before last, I had a little surgery, so I couldn't eat anything, and my surgery was at 12:45, so I couldn't eat from midnight. Couldn't drink coffee. Couldn't do anything. Boy, all of a sudden I'm getting these feelings, and I'm dizzy, and I got a headache, and I've got this stuff going in, and I'm like, oh my God, I used to live like that all the time. That's how I used to live, without eating. And I was talking to some of the, you know, the women I sponsor, and I said, I don't see how you guys live like that. I couldn't stand that feeling anymore. Just being absolutely stoned on your own juices is what it is. It's just like your body's chewing on itself. I said, my God, I can't even imagine that feeling. And see, I've done that. I have done that. And what I realize is because of this program, I don't do that anymore, and I don't like that feeling anymore. I don't like that feeling. I like that feeling of, oh. May you ever feel like that when they took a drink of alcohol? Oh. That's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has done. Oh. Easy feeling down inside of there. The following list is by no means a complete register of emotional mischief makers. However, our recognition and treatment of these will certainly provide the strength, hope, and experience to overcome any others one day at a time, sometimes one moment at a time. Okay, smoke break. Okay, now we're going to get into the meat and potatoes of these little emotional intoxicants. And I think that you could certainly call if we're having emotional hangovers, the book talks about, then obviously we were emotionally intoxicated. So my emotions can definitely get to me. Anger, a deadly poison to sanity and serenity, a special punch to those who want to be God in their own lives. Its impact succeeds in obliterating reason and self-control. One can enjoy being a human hurricane while plunged into the depths of this emotional intoxicant. Sometimes the debris left after the storm is staggering. One of the things that I think that it happens is I was full of rage. And I don't know, I always say anger and rage, but I could just, you know, when you get angry, I don't know if it works for you, but it is for me. If I keep thinking about it or keep staying angry, it just feeds on itself, and I just get angrier and angrier and angrier, and then I just can't stop. And I used to look at my father, and I hated him for that. And I was far and away worse, and I have done so many things that I am so ashamed of. And, you know, the thing about it is that forgiveness, and kids are, certainly my children, have been very forgiving. But, you know, most of the time we can forgive, but we don't usually forget. And that's the difference. And if we do these things and we say these things, always remember, they're there forever. It's there forever. So anger is really, really something that alcoholics need to really, really watch. Solution. If just one whiff of anger sets up the compulsion to act on it, and it is, it's just like a compulsion. Once you start, you just, you know, it just sort of like builds on itself. Practice total abstinence. What does the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous say? The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says anger has to be left to those that can deal with it. We are not people who can deal with anger. We do not know how to deal with anger. And somebody says, you know, you have to learn to, what is it, this new psychology thing, fight fair. Anybody know about fighting fair? I have to not fight. That's what I have to cease fighting any and everything. I don't know how to fight fair. I have to learn to not fight because I don't fight fair. Should the compulsion get the upper hand, third and fifth step it when sanity has returned. Strength to resist taking the first drink of anger comes from daily use of the 12 steps, slogan list, and a willingness to assume responsibility for one's own conduct. There's that nasty word again. Responsibility. And, you know, it's like we can't use excuses anymore. We have the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a wonderful God. We have this beautiful program. I can no longer say, well, I just couldn't help it. I got angry. I've got to take responsibility and start looking at what is it that triggers this anger? What causes me to do the things I do? And most of the time, what makes me so angry is because somebody's just not doing what I want them to do. That is usually what makes me angry. In every situation, whether it's driving down the freeway, whether it's trying to get help in a retail store, whatever it is. And, you know, one of the things that I want to say that it's really important, I think to be sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is a responsibility. I think we have a responsibility to this program as to how we act outside this program. Because this is a program of attraction, and how we behave outside these rooms is really important. You know, it's easy for me to come in here and be wonderful because I'm getting love, and since I'm here as the guest speaker, I'm getting a lot of attention. Why, it's easy. But when I, you know, it's what I have to do is when I live out there every day, and I'm out there more than I get to be in here. I wish that wasn't true. You know, I have the, you know, I've been saying this for years, but it's not happening. I just keep saying, but God, I could be of so much more service if I didn't have to work. And I just hear this voice, go to work. So I get to spend more time out there than I do in here. So I need to practice these principles in all my affairs. And I think it's a responsibility how we act out there. And I want to just share a little story with you why I'm really convinced of that now. I have felt like that. Today I'm thoroughly convinced of that. My little granddaughter was going to be a year old, and this was in last September. And Dave and I needed to go up north to talk at a meeting, and we were going to have this little birthday party on Sunday. Well, we were going to be coming back early Sunday morning from up north, and we were going to stop by and pick up this. I wanted to order a Subway sandwich, and then we were going to have her birthday party. And so I ordered the Subway sandwich on Friday before we left for this little conference. And so we're needing to drive to Northern California, and it's Friday night traffic, and I could give you a thousand reasons of why I was in a hurry, up, you know, and needing to get, you know, you ever in that way, just, hey, come on, gotta get it done, and so I go into this Subway, and there's these two women over here, and they're just chit-chatting, and they're laughing, and they're doing all this stuff, and I'm just sitting there, you know, moving from one foot to the other. And I'm wanting to say something. I'm wanting to say, hello, you have a customer, do you mind stopping the chit-chat? You know, there was a million things I wanted to say. But I took actions contrary to the way I felt, and so I just sort of stood there. And pretty soon they see me, and they go, hi! And she walks over, and she starts taking my order, and she asks me, you know, what I want, give her all that stuff. She says, and what's your name? I said, Polly Pistol. She goes, oh, my God, I heard you talk just this past March at Woman to Woman. Wouldn't that have been great if I had acted like I felt? Now, I have said it for years that we need to take actions contrary to the way we feel, and when we're out, we need to behave as principled members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was proven that. And it was really funny because after I had talked another time, and this lady was in a meeting, and we were up at Woman to Woman this year, and she says, oh my God, I just had no idea I was doing that. She says, you helped me. She says, I know, I just get off into talking and I forget about the customers. So we both learned something. But it's amazing that how I get so irritated and angry, just, and it's because people are not doing what I want them to do. And another thing, not only are they not doing what I want them to do, they're not doing it on my time schedule. My husband is always saying that, Polly, am I not performing according to your time schedule? Because I'll ask him to do something, and I'm sure none of you do this. This is another little insidious anger. I'll ask him to do something. He doesn't do it quick enough. Then I start doing it. But I'm doing it. Slamming doors, showing up, you know, to make sure he can see I'm doing it. Anybody ever do that? He says, how are they going to know you're mad if you don't do that? But the thing about it is I just look at Dave, and he's just standing there, you know, looking at this, and who's all churned up and stewed up and uncomfortable? It's not Dave. It's me. He thinks it's hysterical. Anger needs to be left to those that can handle it. Stop. Say the serenity prayer. Pick up the phone. The quickest way for me to stop being angry is to call somebody. You got a newcomer? That's even better. Call a newcomer. And I'm certainly one of these people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never gotten too sober not to call a newcomer. Call a newcomer. How you doing? How's it going today? And they'll start saying all this stuff, and then you can spout out all your words of wisdom, and the anger just goes. Amazing. Amazing. I can't afford anger today. I am the kind of person that anger feeds on, and it becomes more and more, and then I can't let go of it, and I can't let go of it, and I have to talk about it, and I play it. And it's just a poison, an absolute poison. Intolerance. What did Dr. Bob say that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was? That this is love and tolerance. And it is absolutely, here we are, the most intolerable people on earth and have no tolerance of others. We have taken people to the last inch of their nerves as alcoholics. And then we stand in intolerance. If they ever really take a look at us, God. We got this new little dog. Oh, Jill, I hadn't told you about the new little dog. We had this wonderful little dog named Winston. And Winston was just such an example of love. And he's heard so many fifth steps, and anybody would come over to give a fifth step, and Winston would just snuggle up to him, put his head on their lap, and he was just so precious. And Winston had cancer and congestive heart failure, and he got up every day happy, jumping around. The last day of his life, he was just running down the path. We took him for a walk before we took him to the vet, and he was just a joy, just totally a joy. And Dave and I were just devastated because we had to put this little dog down. And it was just one of those things of doing what you have to do because it's the right thing to do, but you don't want to do it. And so while I was away, weekend before last, Dave doesn't know how to hardly do this, but he calls me. He says, well, I never was ever going to get a dog without you seeing the dog. But Susie and I found this dog, and he's just so precious. And he named him Henry. And it's just so funny because it's like it's such an example of us in the program. Dave goes around and they sing that song, Henry the Eighth, I Am, you know. And it's just like, and I think all I can think of is an alcoholic, and that's who we are. Look at who I am, Henry the Eighth, I Am. You know, it's just like I want what I want when I want it. And totally intolerable of anybody else. It's amazing. I don't know why that came to my mind. And you're going to find that I just... You know, I don't know if I'm ADD or what I am, but I just go off in all sorts of directions. But it's my workshop, so I can do what I want to do. I can stand up here and let you know that it's a proven fact that insane people can live and be happy on this earth. Intolerance, an emotional inebriate which fouls up 12-step work. It succeeds in blocking awareness of what has been shared with one in the program. It causes emotional biases and prejudice. Solution, daily doses of live and let live plus an open mind. Seek to develop compassion, the highest form of emotional maturity. Begin with self-compassion, that is, be good to yourself. Self-compassion means realizing the meaning, quality, and intensity of one's own emotions. The emotional identification of self enables you to feel with others. Learn to distinguish between person and his behavior and detach from the problem but not the person. Wonderful, wonderful Al-Anon lessons, alcoholic women. Because I think we as alcoholics tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You hurt me, you're done. That's it. I have one of the women I work with, she says, you hurt my feelers and I'll turn you into a chair. Just, you don't exist. And I think we tend to do that. And what we have a really hard time doing is having any tolerance to distinguish a person from a person's behavior. And you know, the person is always going to be the person. But what happens is because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a person's behavior can change. And I am so grateful on my knees every day that people have loved me and have allowed me to change and be the person I have been and not throw me away. But I can tell you, I'm very guilty of throwing people away. Not so much today, but I have been. I'm really sorry for those things. There's things I've learned, and I say this a lot of times. I am married, I think I said it last night, I can't remember, but I'm married to the most wonderful man in the world. I had a wonderful husband to start with. My ex-husband was wonderful. And if I knew today what I know now, I would still be married to my ex-husband. Because I feel like today marriage is a huge commitment. You don't leave just because things are not going your way. Now, I'm glad it's worked out the way it has. It's worked out just the way it's supposed to. But I understand those things today. There was absolutely nothing wrong with that man except my intolerance to accept him for who he is. He accepted me, and I was pretty unacceptable. Ellen, who is my sponsor in between Dottie and now back to Dottie, and Ellen used to have this thing, you have to love the unlovable. Or it's not love at all. You have to forgive the unforgivable, or it's not forgiveness at all. You have to tolerate the intolerable, or it's not tolerance at all. And I think those are the things that we have to learn to do. And mostly, for no other reason, that if you can't come with any other reason other than it was done for me. It was done for me.